Good evening. It's delightful to be in front of you again. In his first letter to the Corinthians, the Apostle Paul says, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many of you were powerful. Not many of you were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are." So tonight, I hope to tell you the story of one of the weak and despised people that God used to shame the strong. We know him as Patrick of Ireland. To tell you the story of Patrick, I'm going to break this evening down into three parts. First, I'll give you the setting of his life, and then I hope to give you the narrative of his life, the story, what happened. And then, the last part, I intend to read you a number of excerpts from his letters so you can get a sense of who he is. I call it kind of painting a portrait of him, adding some details in through his own words so you can hear what sort of a person he is. And this is really quite a gift to have details like this. It's a gift to hear his writing. If you understand how rare it is to find writing from people that lived this long ago, you'll understand what a gift this is. So the sources are a little bit disputed. We have his letters, and then we have, centuries later, a bunch of church historians who write about him. But those historians usually include a lot of miracles that we would look at a little bit suspiciously. Now, miracles aren't a problem, but the kind of miracles they're recording sometimes include dragons and things like that, and probably we're going to take these with a grain of salt. So a lot of our knowledge of who Patrick is does come from his letters, so I hope to read those to you eventually. The sources for this talk are How the Irish Saved Civilization, by Thomas K. Hill, and St. Patrick of Ireland by Philip Freeman. Freeman's book has some nice translations of Patrick's letters, and that's where these excerpts are going to come from. Well, first, let's put Patrick in his context. So I think it's helpful to have a time frame for him. So I put up a very rough time line here. This is the only reason I'm doing this is to give you a rough idea of when Patrick occurred. I picked a couple of dates at random. So you have the birth of Jesus, and then about 300 years later, the rise of Constantine the Great, and then you have Patrick about 100 years after, well, not quite 100 years after Constantine the Great. So from Jesus to Patrick, around 400 years, and about 200-ish, 250 years later, along comes Muhammad, and he dies. And then about 400 years on the other end of Patrick, you have Charlemagne being crowned Holy Roman Emperor. So that gives you a bit of a sense of when Patrick occurred. So 400 years before him was Jesus, 400 years after him was Charlemagne. Hopefully that'll give you a bit of a sense of what context to put Charlemagne in. So, I'm struggling here a little bit. There we go. So, the next thing I want to do is put him into a location. So, here is Western Europe. Here is the boundaries of the Roman Empire at its height. Now, by the time of Patrick, we are no longer looking at a Rome that looked like this. Patrick lived at the very end of the Roman Empire. You had a bunch of things going on. So up here in this area, we had what we call the Germanic tribes. And these tribes, well, to put it kindly, they were not nice to Romans. They were warlike. So you had what's going on here at about the time of Patrick's birth is the tribes in this area begin to migrate across the borders. And not just a few of them. They all seem to get the same idea at the same time. And they're putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the Roman Empire. The Eastern Roman Empire over here, based in about this area right there, is largely adopting a policy of pushing the barbarians to the west. And so that means that the Western Roman Empire, which was weak, dealt with just an incredible number of barbarian incursions, including in 410. Now, this has been when Patrick was about, probably close to 20 years old. The city of Rome was sacked for the first time in about 800 years by a tribe of Goths that had been living here, and they moved up and into this area, sacked Rome, and continued to plunder around, putting emperors on the throne or cutting deals with emperors. So the Roman Empire was still sort of existing, but it was usually held hostage by these Germanic tribes that didn't even speak Latin. Many of them were not Christian, although the Goths were. They were Arian Christians. So Patrick is living over here. He's born here right about the time that things really heated up in this area. So you had all kinds of Germanic tribes kind of making a mess over here, like I am on the slide. Now, as you can imagine, the lines of communication between Britain and Rome here, which it's actually not Rome anymore, it's another city. We're not going to get into that, but it's another city in Rome that was largely the seat of the empire. The communications between these two places are nearly severed. So in 410, the Emperor Honorius gets this letter from the Britons over here. And they said, we desperately need help because, well, these scary people up here are the Picts. They're starting to raid the Scotti from Ireland. And if you notice, that sounds a lot like Scotland. It does, because those tribes eventually migrate to what we now know as Scotland and kind of mingle with the Picts. And that's where that comes from. But anyhow, the Scotti were making raids. The Angles and the Jutes and the Saxons from this area were making raids, and these people needed help from Rome, and they said, help us, send some Roman legions. So this is all happening when Patrick is about teens, 20s. Well, the Emperor Honorius over here sends a letter back. It's a really famous letter. It says, sorry, you're on your own. We don't have any legions to spare. We have this mess over here in the continent. And we've got Germans breathing down our necks, sacking Rome. We can't do anything. We're pulling out the legions that are in Britain, and we're putting them to use somewhere else. So that is pretty much the end of official Roman rule of Britain. As you might imagine, it wasn't really the end of Roman culture. So, let me erase this ink so you can get a better sense of what I'm about to say here. So in this area, what was once the Roman Empire, think big scale. So you had everything organized in a large industrial scale organization. You had big cities, you had big government, you had all of this land split up into what we would see as states, kind of, but they called it provinces, and everything was organized on a large scale. You had these huge farms that would grow things and sell them to cities. Well, about the time of Patrick, with this massive German influx, you had Britain getting isolated over here, and at that time it had been called Britannia, was isolated. And so what happens is you went from large-scale industrial-style organization of the entire society and country into basically just fractured into the smallest pieces. So if that were to happen in the United States today, the closest thing I can get to is you would probably break up into counties. And so we would stop seeing ourselves as being part of the United States, or maybe we wouldn't stop seeing ourselves that way, but functionally, we would start to operate within a fairly closed community, the county of Reno County, or maybe a little bit bigger area than that. But whatever the case is, you had all these little areas in Britain, all with the Roman administration that had been there is now the only administration. There's nobody looking over their shoulders. And so they kind of turn into these strongmen. And this is probably about the time that the myths that we have of King Arthur probably begin forming in about this area, where some small Roman warlord or administrator kind of grabs his little chunk of the empire and organizes it and uses it to maybe band together with a couple other small ones and push back the Saxons, etc. So this is the time of Patrick. That's what we're thinking about. So in Britannia, where Patrick is born, things are really changing. It's a time of great transition. A few other things to note about this. The empire has been, I'll call it Christian, for not quite 100 years. And by the time Patrick, the Battle of the Milvian Bridge happened about 312, so, you know, Patrick would have lived for the, been alive at the 100-year anniversary. So the church officials had become incredibly powerful. Oftentimes, these strongman Roman administrators were church officials. In fact, if you wanted to be one of the, in the civil service in Rome, you had better become a Christian. That recently changed at the time of Patrick, but it had changed. So, church leaders are picking up a lot of the slack from the imperial system. You had bishops that were leading armies. And that's the church that Patrick is born into. That's the church he's a part of. That's helpful to remember. I'm not sure how it affects the story entirely, but you need to know this. That's what's going on. One other thing I'd like to talk about is the culture of Britain, or Britannia. So it used to be Celtic, and we're going to talk more about Celts when we talk about Ireland. But when the Romans came in, they Romanized the place. They taught people to speak Latin. They taught them the classics. They taught them how to use money. That was a foreign concept, so they introduced money. Things became organized and systematized, which was just exactly the opposite of the Celtic culture. And so that's been a shift that's happened for centuries now, several centuries. The lower part of the island is pretty heavily Romanized. The upper levels, the aristocrats, the landed aristocrats, they were local aristocrats, but they were landed aristocrats, spoke Latin for official business. They could write, they could read Latin. There was a Britannic language, or Brythonic, I think was the term for it, and it eventually changed into what we now know as Welsh, or Welsh is actually an old language, but it would have been influenced by this. So this Welsh is the remnants of the Celtic, original Celtic language of the island. Enough about Britain. Let's look at Ireland. And I think the next slide would be more useful for that, so let's go here. So, we're zooming in. Now, the Romans said that Ireland was beyond the edge of the world. So, Britain was at the edge, and Ireland was, you know, kind of out there. It was cold, nasty, and who wants it? It's not even worth invading and taking. So, they never bothered to make the short hop. Probably at least partly because they were having so much trouble with these Picts up here. The Picts were the painted people, and there was some relation with the Irish. They were remnants of a Celtic culture. So let's look at Ireland at the time of Patrick. So, do you know what Celts are? Can somebody give me a bit of an idea of what the Celts are? You've probably heard of them, but do you know who they are and what they are? Okay, so a long time ago, this is before the Roman Empire really became powerful, the Celtic culture spread clear through northwestern Europe. So about 800 years before Patrick, the Celts had sacked Rome. That was when Rome was just beginning its ascent to power. And this left a deep, deep mark on the Roman psyche. And a lot of their foreign policy was shaped by this sacking of Rome. And they were called long-haired Celts, I think is what they were called. But anyhow, the Celts were known as a warrior culture. They had some pretty strange beliefs. When they went into battle, they had these great big long swords, and they would swing them around their heads, and they were terrifying. But the Romans learned how to deal with some of these things. Their women were extra scary, too. The one writer says the women are just as terrifying as the men. And when they go into battle with the men, which they did occasionally, you want to look out for them. So the Celts are, think of them as kind of tribal, and yet they're more than tribal. The Celtic culture spanned tribes. And so when you see Celtic culture cropping up here in Ireland and in Britain, you know that it's more than just a tribal phenomenon. It is actually a culture that stood, that arched over tribal boundaries. In fact, there is a strong ethnic component. They've done some DNA testing and stuff, and they've linked the Celtic culture clear across Europe to the modern people that live there now. So it seems like it was a cultural thing, but it was also an ethnic, there was an ethnic component to it. They tended to, I don't want to duplicate myself because I'm going to talk a little bit more about this when let me give you just a little bit of an overview of it, and then I'll dig into it a little bit more when I talk about what kind of stuff Patrick dealt with. So, the Druids are Celtic. They were the priests of the Celtic religion. They tended to put a lot of emphasis on trees and nature. There was human sacrifice, pretty dark stuff that went on. So it's tribal, and yet there's a culture that spans the tribal element of it. And it's also, there's a religious component. So those are some of the things you need to remember. Ireland as a whole now, at this time, is fractured into all kinds of little kingdoms. So they have kings, lots and lots of little kings, several dozen kings. And there was sometimes a high king who ruled all these other kings. If you think of these guys as sheriffs, county sheriffs, you're probably not terribly far off. So Ireland is kind of the opposite of Rome. Whereas Rome is large-scale organization, Ireland is small-scale organization. It's fractured. It's tiny. They fight each other. They like to raid cattle from each other. And you can get into some of the strange poems and stuff of how they went about on these cattle raids, and they would make these grandiose poems, epic poems, about how they went and stole somebody's bull. You know, this is a big deal. So, think of Ireland as the opposite of everything Roman. It's small, it's decentralized, there's no written language, there's very little monetary interaction. They do keep some coins and stuff, but there's really no large-scale organized economic system. That's the setting for Patrick. Now, I want to dig into his life. So, most of what I'm going to be telling you next comes from a letter he wrote defending himself against some charges of, or a variety of charges. And in that letter, he writes his story. He tells his story, talks about what he's done and how he got to where he is. So, he's born in the 390s. We don't know exact dates there. And in England, and probably here along the west coast of England somewhere. I don't know exactly where along here, but probably along the west coast, and you'll find out soon why I say that. He was born into low-grade aristocracy. He was of noble-ish birth. His dad was a deacon. His father before him was a priest. So his grandfather was a priest. His dad's a deacon. And by the way, the priests could marry at that time. That was before the whole outlawing of marriage and stuff for priests. being the deacon set you up to be a possible bishop, which was about the highest you could expect to go unless you somehow managed to become an archbishop or, even more importantly, the pope. So, here is Patrick, born somewhere in here into modest nobility. His family has a country estate. That means they've got some money. At about 15 years old, something striking happens. And this is linked to what I've been telling you about all the conflict that's going on in this time. When he is 15 or almost 16 years old, a band of Irish slavers, so raiders from this, think pirates, raided his family's country estate and grabbed him. They popped him into handcuffs and irons and took him back over to Ireland and sold him to probably a petty chieftain. And he spent the next 6 years basically out on the hillsides, freezing cold or wet or whatever else came at him, herding sheep. That was his job. Up until now, he says he was not really much of a Christian. He claims that he had pretty much turned his back on religion. It was just kind of something the old people did, and he really had no interest in it. But now things are changing. He is suddenly experiencing a great deal of discomfort. He's a slave. And slaves in Ireland didn't have much chance of getting out of slavery. If you're a Roman slave, you could eventually buy yourself freedom, usually. So there were ways to get out of slavery in Roman life. But in Ireland, you're going to have a difficult time getting out of slavery. So he's a slave for 6 years. I'll kind of spoiler alert here. So as a slave, he begins thinking about his religion more seriously. Now, all he really says about this is that it seems like herding sheep sort of prepared him to care for people. It's kind of a fascinating concept. This is a lot like Moses stuck out in the desert herding those sheep. Although I think it was probably every bit as uncomfortable in Ireland to be out there from what it sounds like anyhow. And so he begins to pray. And he says he could do up to 100 prayers a day. And sometimes, even through the night, he would pray. Now, when he talks about doing prayers, I'm assuming there was kind of a set prayer that he was praying. And this was, you know, not far removed from what we think of Catholicism. And so probably it was kind of a ritualized prayer of some sort. But the other slaves kind of noticed this. And it seems they may have given him some derogatory names. Later on, you'll probably hear me read an excerpt where it talks, in a vision, he is called Holy Boy. I suspect that may have come about during this time as a slave. He's being noticed by the other slaves. And he's fasting. Now, if you're a slave and you're hungry and you're ill-fed, the last thing other people would expect you to do is start fasting. But because of his growing piety and his growing connection with Jesus, he begins to fast, he begins to pray, and things start changing inside of him. He becomes far more devout. At some point, he has a vision, and he hears God telling him to leave. And he's like, how in the world am I going to leave? Now, before we go too much farther, I should move my laser pointer because we really have no idea where he's at, but he's probably not close to this side because he talks about walking for almost 200 Roman miles to get to the port, which was on the west side of Ireland. So he's probably, on the east side of Ireland. So he's probably on the west side is probably where he's at. So the voice tells him to leave, and finally he says, okay. He grabs his stuff. And he escapes, and he walks through this minefield, if you wish. This is a land full of petty kings. One king's territory is sovereign. It's no way related to the next king. So there aren't roads that go through them. So he's stumbling from one state, one country, into another country. Think of it kind of like walking through maybe Central America, where you have a lot of small countries. So he's walking across here. He doesn't really say what all happens, but he gets over here and he finds a port with his ship, and he goes down and he says, I'd like to go with you. And the captain says, get out of here. We don't want any more people. So he turns around and starts walking away, and he's in despair. What's going to happen? And suddenly he hears somebody saying, come back. And it's one of the sailors came running after him and said, yeah, we'll take you. And so he goes with them. And then strangely, they sail for several days. Now, where that may be, we have no idea. Honestly, it's quite a mystery because this is not a very long journey across here. It would only take a day or less. So He may have sailed way up here or way down here or even to the continent. We don't really know. Whatever the case is, he gets to land. They get on land and they travel for most of a month. And they're running out of food. There aren't people around. And the leader says, okay, you, Patrick, you're always praying to your God. Do something. Let's have a miracle. You know, we need food. We're dying. And so Patrick says, okay, you'll have your food later on today. He prayed and he said the food will come. And sure enough, a herd of pigs crossed their paths. And so they ate well on pork. And that's about all we know about his escape. That's kind of it. It'd be fun to have a little more detail, but we don't have more. It says eventually he gets back to England. We don't know exactly. Let me back up. We don't know exactly when he got to England or how hard it was to find his family, but he gets back home. And he settles in. It'd be nice to stay here. I'm back home. Now, one thing to think about. He left when he was 16. That's pretty much the end of high school, for educationally speaking, for a Latin at that time, or for a Roman citizen. If you intended to hold any kind of high office, you're going to need college. And college started right about then, and it lasted for about the next 6 years or so. That's when he was a slave. So he is going to need to do something, except he's too old. And so he never really receives that education. And later on, he writes about how writing Latin and speaking Latin is just kind of clumsy to him. And he doesn't feel well educated. And there are other churchmen, especially. The churchmen would have been the most educated people, who are far more educated. And he felt hampered by this all his life. So he's back home. Everybody's thinking he needs to work hard to get back to where he was. And then he started having visions. Now, visions are something Patrick had quite a few of. And I'd like to read a few of these to you, so you get a sense of how powerful these visions are. And they have the visions he feels are calling him back to Ireland, which is the strangest place in the world for him to go. Because he just left, and his life is probably in danger if he gets back to his old slave master. So, to give you a sense of how powerful, how important these visions were in motivating him, I'm going to read you his recounting of a few of the visions. But one night, while I was at home, I saw a vision while sleeping. It was a man named Victoricus coming to me as if he were arriving from Ireland. With him, he brought a huge number of letters. He gave me one of them. And I saw that the first words were, "The voice of the Irish." When I began to read this letter, all of a sudden I heard the voices of those Irish who lived near the woods of Folcott, near the Western Sea. They called out to me with a single voice, "We beg you, holy boy, come here and walk among us." I felt my heart breaking and was not able to read anymore. And so I woke up. But thanks be to God, because after many years, the Lord made their prayer come true. And another vision. And there was another time I had a vision. I saw someone praying in me. It was as if I were actually out inside my own body. I heard him above me, that is, the internal me. There he was, praying forcefully with great sighs. While this was happening, I was stunned and baffled and kept asking myself, "Who is this who is praying inside of me?" But at the end of the prayer, he spoke to me and said he was the Spirit. And then I woke up and remembered what the apostle said. The Spirit helps us when we don't know how to pray or what we ought to pray for. The Spirit prays with a language which goes beyond mere words. And again, the Lord is our spokesman who prays for us. So Patrick begins having these dreams. These dreams are powerful, they're meaningful, and they connect with him emotionally. Now, I can't help but think that some of this is related to the hardships he went through while he was there. Just the difficulty of living as a slave. And now he's back, everything's safe, and he realizes that he has a ministry back there to those people who are slaves still, and also the people who are enslaving other people. So, the next part is the most frustrating part, because we have no idea how he went about preparing to go back. There were other missionaries to the Picts up in here. There was a famous missionary. Maybe he went with him. It would have been about the right time. All we know is that sometime in the 430s or a little later, he ends up back in Ireland. Now, there was another bishop of Ireland before him. There was a man sent from Rome to Ireland. His name was Palladius. And all we know is that he was there a year and left. Did Patrick go with him? Well, it seems very likely that he would have. Are the dates skewed so that Patrick looks better? We don't know that, because all of those dates come from church historians writing hundreds of years later. We don't know how accurate they are, but probably something is going on here. So, there is a bishop before Patrick. He only lasts a short period of time, and then we find out Patrick is bishop of Ireland. But we don't know how much of Ireland he's really the bishop of. Because remember, Ireland is all fractured into tiny little kingdoms. There is no pan-Ireland at this time. So there's just a whole lot we don't know. He seems to have answered to the fellow bishops in Britain. So we don't have him writing to the Pope in Rome, way back over here somewhere. We have him writing letters to the bishops in Britain, answering accusations to them. So, was he sent by the British church? Well, almost certainly there was some kind of oversight there. Did the Pope have anything to do with his mission? We don't know. It would be interesting to answer a lot of those questions, but we simply do not have enough information to go on. So, what I'd like to talk about next is just a little bit more speculative, and that is what actually is going on in his ministry back to the former slaveholders. A few things we know about. We know that his converts were mostly women and slaves. Now, if that reminds you of the early church period, that's good, because it should. Because the church spread in the first two centuries of church growth, it was primarily in the women and minorities and slaves. Christianity is a religion that, I think in its purest form, appeals most rapidly to the people who are pushed down. So this powerful new religion is spreading among the underprivileged people, and Patrick finds himself as a bishop mostly of slaves and women. Now, it's important that he mentions women, because women did not have all that much legal rights, all that many legal rights. There's a lot they didn't have. And so they were somewhat oppressed. But in addition to women, it was in particular noble women. He had quite a few converts that were noble women. Now, because of the time that he's operating in, monasticism is a big thing. And one of the hallmarks of Celtic Christianity, in other words, the Christianity that Patrick kind of founded over here in Ireland, one of the hallmarks of Celtic Christianity is that it emphasized monasticism. And so these monks would go out, and they would find some hideaway to live in, and since they couldn't, they idealized martyrdom, but you couldn't find somebody to kill you in Ireland because everybody was Christian, so you chose martyrdom differently. They called it green martyrdom, which was go out in the woods, find an out-of-the-way place, build a little hut, live there, a life of an ascetic, study the Bible, and write. They did a bunch of writing, and they were really important in writing, in maintaining the Latin language during this time that the Germanic tribes were back on the continent creating havoc. So they'd find this little hut, and they would start doing their thing. Pretty soon somebody else would come and say, "Oh, great teacher, may I live with you?" And he'd say, "Sure, build a hut." And so they'd build a hut, and then there would be two, and then there would be three that come along, and pretty soon you had a whole area that was a monastery, essentially. These little beehive huts, they were kind of shaped like beehives, set up in an area. And they would go, well, once they got too crowded, they'd send people out to other places, and eventually you had people going up here to Iona, close to off the coast of Scotland. There were all these islands they could settle on, and so they did that. And Celtic Christianity just exploded. It spread clear through Ireland. I don't know how quickly, but certainly probably Patrick saw a bunch of this happen. And eventually, after his life, within 100 years, it had traveled up here into this area. Celtic Christians are the main evangelizers of the wild Picts up here. It even spread over to the continent. You can't see it over here, but it's over in here somewhere. So Celtic Christianity is really powerful because it's spreading while the Germanic tribes... Let me just back up a couple... Okay, so what we have going on here is you have Celtic Christianity moving from this area up into this area and eventually coming all the way down over to the continent. It's even have monasteries showing up in what we now know of as Italy, in the Alps in here. It moves this way into England, and there's a whole lot more history going on that I can't talk about, but suffice it to say you've got a bunch of Angles and Saxons down here. The Pope is finally catching up several hundred years later. I think it's about 100. I forget the dates. Several hundred years later, I believe, Augustine comes into this area, and he is from the Pope. He's setting up Roman Christianity, and they gradually spread through the Angles and the Saxons, and Celtic Christianity meets Roman Christianity right in here somewhere. And they have this big fight because they're not the same anymore. Because you see, Patrick had moved over there, been cut off, isolated, and spread while all of these pagans were running around down in here. And then these guys became Christian, and eventually it worked for Rome to start sending missionaries back up and into the wild lands of Britannia. And now you have these two different groups meeting after a couple of hundred years. They have different Easters. They have different, even some different holidays, but different ways of keeping track of time. And they don't quite see eye to eye, and they have this big synod. And this is completely off the subject of Patrick, so I have to stop. But anyhow, that's what happens to Patrick's descendants. Now, let's get back to where Patrick is. So he's in Ireland here. He is converting women and slaves, and he has to deal with kings. And these aren't powerful kings. These are wimpy little kings. These are more like county sheriffs. They just control a small amount of land, and they're usually at war with the guys around them. Actually, in some cases, they're kind of like cattle rustlers, sort of like the Texas cattle barons of 100 years ago, because they like to go stealing each other's cattle. Cattle were important. sheep were not important, by the way. That's why the slaves took care of the sheep. So here is Patrick trying to get around in this area, and he keeps bumping into borders. He has to cross these borders. What do you do? Well, in some of his writing, he defends his use of the money he gets. He says, I used it to pay off the kings. Now, you think that sounds like bribery, but it was just acts of generosity. You see, Celtic culture really emphasized generosity and courage, manly virtues like this. And so if he wanted to get anywhere, he's going to have to offer gifts. So he'd pay the kings to let him come through their land. He would pay their war bands. Don't think army. They didn't have armies. They had little groups of peacocks, guys who really liked to dress up their swords. They'd put jewels on their swords, and they'd strut around all their finery, and they just lived to kill other people when the time was right. So they're not really nice people, but they're part of the king's bodyguard, his war band. So Patrick would pay those guys to get him through the king's land, or to keep them from capturing him. But it didn't always work. He says he was recaptured into slavery at some point. But he said he didn't worry about it because God told him in a vision that he's going to be released in 2 months. And in 2 months, some of his friends came along. He doesn't say who or how many there were or whether they had swords or not. But he was released after 2 months. So he was retaken as a slave. This was after he was a bishop of Ireland. But he got free. He also talks about these war bands sometimes taking his money and then robbing him. Bummer. You know, you can't trust these guys. So, Patrick is not coming as a conquering hero. He is coming as a poor, uneducated ex-slave, and he is speaking to slaves and to women, primarily. Those are his converts. That's really important to understand because it changes the feel of Celtic Christianity. It changes how the church looks. It doesn't look like the Roman Catholic Church. It looks a little different. He would have had to contend with Druids. So let's talk about Druids. So the ancient Celts are going to look to their Druids for quite a number of things. And so some of the roles of a Druid was they were priests, but they were also counselors. They were even international negotiators. There are stories of priests, of these Druids walking out between two warring war bands. So guys coming together, getting ready for a fight, they're all psyched up, and a Druid walks in the middle and says, "Stop." And things stopped. The Druids were really powerful. They seemed to be unconnected to the kings. They were a notch above, or they just didn't operate on the same plane. They could be teachers. They also often were prophets. So in the Druidic religion, there were trees that were especially important. And they would worship in surrounded by these trees. They had these sacred groves. Now, it's really hard to get straight answers on who the Druids were and how they worshipped because we get a lot of our information from the Romans. And the reason we do is because the Druids themselves didn't write anything. They didn't have a written language. They had a history, but it was entirely oral. They told these sacred histories to other Druids, but they didn't write anything down. So we really have very little to go on here. But the Romans wrote about them, and the Romans hated them. The Romans were out to get rid of everything Druidic. Now, if they did indeed sacrifice humans, and there's very good evidence to support that they did this, that makes complete sense that the Romans would want to get rid of these humans sacrificing strange, creepy priests. But the Romans had their own pretty gory ways of doing things. If you've read anything about the gladiatorial games, you know the Romans really had nothing to talk about here, and at least from moral, they weren't operating from the moral high ground here. But it does seem like there was something bad about the Druids. But what was really sticking in the Romans' craw was these Druids are too powerful. We can't Romanize the area like we did with the Britons, with the Druids there. We have to get rid of them and replace them with our culture. And so that's what they did in Britain. They completely wiped out the Druids. It talks about them massacring Druids, getting rid of them entirely. So all of our stories are going to come through these enemies of the Druids. And so we have to understand that something may be skewed here. So they almost certainly practiced human sacrifice. They didn't have a written language. They did have, there was some kind of writing. They carved on trees, and it was pretty important that they followed the natural flow of the tree. I know nothing about it, that's about it. So there was some kind of writing, but it was not emphasized much at all, and it didn't contain a lot of information, or we haven't been able to decipher it. I'm not quite sure which. So that's the story of Patrick, of his operation, of how he got to where he was. Now, I hope to give you something more of a real picture of Patrick. So I want you to hear his own words. So this next section, I'm going to be talking about his writings and giving you some excerpts from his writing. Excuse me. So here is Patrick in his own words. There are two letters that we have from Patrick. One is a letter to the soldiers of Croticus, very strange name. I am not going to read you excerpts from that. Let me just give you a bit of a summary of it. Basically what happens is Patrick had baptized some Irish and some British slavers, mind you, are coming back this way. That should tell you that there's a lot of turmoil going on. And they attack this small band of Irish Christians that Patrick just got done baptizing. And they killed a bunch of them. They captured a bunch of them and took them back to Britain and sold them into slavery. And Patrick is livid. I mean, angry. like Christians rarely are supposed to get. And he writes this blistering letter to them, and he is telling them how horrible they are. And then he proceeds to say, any Christian in Britain that fellowships with these guys should stop right now, because they're awful. And we need to stop fellowshipping with them until they return those Irish Christians, the ones that they didn't kill, and are sorry for what they have done. So that's one side of Patrick, but we're not going to get into that side too much. I wanted to emphasize his other letter that we have called Confessions. Now, actually, it's Confessio or something like that. So it's written in Latin. He is not fluent in Latin. He writes it as a foreign language, he says. Both of his letters start with something I find extremely important. So I will read you the beginning of his confession, and that will give you a bit of a sense of how he felt about himself, give you a picture of this. And what he starts with always is, I am Patrick, a sinner. Now, I think that's fascinating. It gives me a picture of Patrick that pleases me. Somebody humble who recognizes what he has been forgiven from. So I'm Patrick, a sinner, the most unsophisticated and unworthy among all the faithful of God. Indeed, to many, I am most despised. So a couple of other excerpts. Once I was a crude and ignorant exile who didn't even know how I could take care of myself in the future. This much I know for certain. Before God humbled me, I was like a stone stuck deep in a mud puddle. But then God came along and with his power and compassion reached down and pulled me out, raised me up, and placed me on top of a wall. Because of this, I must proclaim my good news. I must pay God back in some way for all that he has done for me here on earth and what he will do in eternity. Blessings no one can even imagine. Are you getting a sense of a man who is both humble and passionate, deeply passionate? Passionate enough to get very angry on occasion. This is a human. He is a man. And that's what his letters bring out the most, I think. Another excerpt. Ah, sorry, I read my notes wrong. Could not figure out why it wasn't there. There was another paragraph I was going to read right close to this. Okay, so listen to me well, all of you, great and small, everyone who has any fear of God, especially you wealthy landowners, so proud of your education. Do you hear that? He's remembering the education he didn't get. So proud of your education. Listen and consider this carefully. God chose foolish little me from among all of you who seem so wise and so expert in the law and so powerful in your eloquence. He picked ignorant Patrick ahead of all of you. Even though I am not worthy, he picked me to go forth with fear and reverence and without any of you complaining at the time to serve the Irish faithfully. The love of Christ carried me here to be a help to these people for the rest of my life, if I may be worthy, and to work for them with humility and in sincerity. So he really does see himself as the least of these. He sees himself as Patrick the sinner, ignorant. And that, I think, is part of his power. Remember what I talked about at the beginning? The despised among you will overcome the powerful. That's how he sees himself, and that, I think, is really what's going on here. I have been offered many gifts here by those sorry for their sins, but I turned them all down. This angered some of my superiors, but with the help of God, I fought back and did not give in to them. No thanks of my own will, but of the power of God who lives in me and resists them. I came to Ireland to preach the good news and to suffer abuse from unbelievers. Notice how he's coming in humility. He's coming in weakness. And it seems to me and it seems, to have my mission shamefully criticized. I've had many hard times, even to the point of being enslaved again, but I traded in my free birth for the good of others. If I am worthy, I am even ready to lay down my life willingly and without hesitation for his name. Here in Ireland is where I wish to live out my final days, if God will permit me. And lastly, if I had been given the same education as others, I could not keep silent. Sorry. If I had been given the same education as others, I could not keep silent because of my feelings of thankfulness to God. So perhaps it may seem to people that I'm very presumptuous to write such a letter in my ignorant and sputtering style. Still, the scripture does say, a stammering tongue will quickly learn to speak peace. How much more ought I to make such an effort? I, who am myself a letter of Christ for the work of salvation to the end of the earth. Even if I am not written well, I'm still a solid and faithful letter, written in your hearts, not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God. And as the Holy Spirit says, even unsophisticated people were created by God. So, in the end, the picture of Patrick that I hope you take away with you is that of a normal human who possessed supernatural love for his fellow humans. And may each of us become a letter of Christ written with the Spirit of the living God. Thank you.